Welcome to Local Talk, where we explore the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I am your host for this hour, Susan Franzen, here together with Pat Schlarbaum and Ursula Rudenberg.
Welcome to Local Talk. Thank you for joining us.
We are all here because it's membership drive time, but more on that later. First, let's look at the weather. It's going to be a nice week with mild temperature on Thanksgiving Day, when it should be sunny and around 46 degrees. Although we have some clouds today, it should be mostly sunny until Thursday with temperatures warming slowly. Early Friday morning may see snow, which is expected to turn into rain by day. Saturday should be sunny and warmer, but Saturday night and Sunday could see some snow or rain. Now here's Dennis Hart with a roundup of Iowa in the news last week. Take it away, Dennis.
Thanks very much. It's great to be back here on this Monday. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds made big news last week. She told reporters at her first news conference since she was elected to a full four-year term that her priorities for next year's legislative session include developing workers' skills, funding education, enacting new tax cuts, and improving Iowa's mental health system. The Republican governor said she wanted to work with Democrats who are in the legislative minority. Both the Iowa House and Senate will continue to be controlled by Republican majorities next year. The governor also signaled last week that she has lost patience with Iowa 4th Congressional District Republican Congressman Steve King. She said King needs to make a decision if he wants to represent the people and the values of the 4th District or do something else. It was the first time Reynolds had issued a broad criticism of the longtime congressman. And Iowa Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley distanced himself from controversy surrounding King last week, saying in part, "I don't talk like that and I don't act like that." This after word that the Weekly Standard magazine had released an audio recording of Congressman King in which he seemed to refer to immigrants from the West Coast as dirt. That recording was made during a King campaign stop on the Monday before the November 6th election. A King spokesperson said the Weekly Standard misrepresented the congressman's comments. There was also word last week that Iowa's Republican U.S. senators will be taking up new leadership positions in the Senate next year. Chuck Grassley will serve as Senate pro tem, which means he will preside over the Senate in the vice president's absence. He's the first Iowan in more than a century to hold the position, which typically goes to the most senior senator in the majority party. And Senator Grassley announced he's giving up his chairmanship of the Senate Judiciary Committee to serve as chairman of the Finance Committee. Meanwhile, Senator Joni Ernst was named vice chairwoman of the Senate Republican Conference. She becomes the first woman elected to Republican Party leadership since 2010. Meanwhile, President Trump gave his official backing to Senator Grassley's criminal justice overhaul efforts last week. If Grassley's plan becomes law, it would shorten mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug crimes, create programs to let prisoners readjust to their communities and stay out of prison, and improve conditions for women in prison. There was more political news last week. Acting U.S. Attorney General Matt Whitaker returned to Iowa to speak in Des Moines at the Rural and Tribal Elder Justice Summit. Whitaker, who is an Iowa native, did not talk about the controversy surrounding his recent appointment to oversee the U.S. Justice Department. He commended the work of Iowa attorneys to help seniors, saying that one of the values Iowans share is respecting elders. Also last week, word that an Iowa Supreme Court justice will resign next month so he can focus on battling skin cancer. 66-year-old Justice Darrell Hecht has served on Iowa's High Court since 2006. A statewide judicial nominating commission will review applications to replace him and submit three finalists for Governor Reynolds for consideration. Also last week, word that an African-American campaign worker who had been canvassing in West Des Moines for Iowa Congressman David Young was arrested after he refused to identify himself or answer questions from officers who had received complaints about door-to-door soliciting. The group Citizens for Community Improvement released video of the October 29th arrest of Keelan Hill of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and cited the incident as an example of what it called racial profiling by metro area police. West Des Moines police said they reviewed the incident and that police acted appropriately. Drake University took the spotlight in several stories last week. It was revealed that four racist notes were received by Drake students, and more than 250 students, faculty, and staff members received white supremacist robocalls last Monday. Meanwhile, thousands from among the Drake community rallied last Wednesday to celebrate diversity and to call for unity. There was also word about another Iowa college campus last week. Officials from Iowa Wesleyan University in Mount Pleasant announced that the small, private liberal arts college will remain open after receiving donations from alumni, community members, and others. The university had struggled financially for the past few years. Also last week, word that the man accused of fatally stabbing Iowa State University student and golfer Celia Barquina Rosamena is asking for a new lawyer because of a communication issue. 22-year-old Colin Richards faces a first-degree murder charge for Barquina Rosamena's death on an Ames golf course in September. Richards is represented by public defender Paul Rounds. Meanwhile, officials in Barquina Rosamena's hometown in Spain have named their municipal sports center after her. The deputy mayor in Puente San Miguel said she represented and represents the value of sports. Also last week, a pregnant woman and her 2-year-old stepson and her unborn baby died in a crash Friday night in southern Clark County. The woman was identified as 22-year-old Bethany Renee Kennedy, who authorities said was driving south on U.S. Highway 69 when she swerved out of her lane and was broadsided by a northbound vehicle. Also last week, a 41-year-old Nevada man died after his car veered off Interstate Highway 35 and struck a bridge in Ankeny. Police said Eric Dean Shaw was the only occupant of the vehicle when the crash took place Friday morning. There was also word that preliminary autopsy results show that 4 people who died in a small plane crash in central Iowa earlier this month were suffering from carbon monoxide poisoning. The crash took place November 9th in rural Guthrie County, about 50 miles west of Des Moines. 3 of those killed in the crash were from Lamar's. 1 person was from Merrill. Last week also brought news that nearly 90 cadets were hospitalized after a carbon monoxide leak at the Iowa Law Enforcement Academy in Johnston. Many of the cadets were showing symptoms such as nausea, headaches, and dizziness. And last week, a report that a pesticide commonly used to eliminate fish from waterways, one that has been linked to Parkinson's disease, will soon be put to use in a Des Moines pond. Iowa's Department of Natural Resources planned to use the pesticide this week on the south side of Easter Lake in order to help get rid of detrimental common carp and gizzard shad from that body of water. A note will be placed on nearby residents' doors 24 hours ahead of time, warning that humans and animals should avoid contact with the water during treatment. There was also a story last week that many Iowa doctors have hesitated to help patients enroll in a new medical marijuana program, which is set to launch next week. As of a few days ago, only 325 of the state's 7,000 actively practicing physicians have certified people for the program. Also last week, Wells Fargo, the single biggest private employer in the Des Moines metro area, announced it will lay off 400 workers. Wells Fargo employs more than 15,000 people in Iowa, including about 14,000 in the Des Moines area. Back in September, the bank announced it would reduce its national workforce by more than 26,000 jobs. And last week, word that the nationwide insurance company will lay off about 80 workers at its downtown Des Moines location as it reduces its national workforce by about 1,100 positions. Workers were told last week that they would receive an official 60-day notice this coming January. That gives them about 4 months of notice before the layoffs become effective in March. There was also word last week that DuPont is slated to give Iowa a $10.5 million check after closing and selling its ethanol plant in Nevada. DuPont has agreed to repay all but about $4 million it received in incentives in 2011. Also last week, word that the federal government issued a report saying that 4 out of 5 Americans are not active enough. The report said adults should get at least 2.5 hours of aerobic exercise and 2 sessions of muscle-strengthening activity each week. The executive director of Iowa's Healthiest State Initiative said those guidelines highlight that state residents, along with other Americans, need to, in his words, move more. Nearly 1 out of 3 Iowans are considered obese. Some good news last week. The lives of 39 children were changed Saturday morning at the Polk County Justice Center. They were officially adopted by 26 families during the 18th annual Polk County Adoption Saturday. There was more last week, including a strange story out of Janesville, where a deer jumped through the window at Janesville School and ran through the superintendent's office before someone guided the animal out the main entrance. The school's principal said the deer broke through his window, leaving quite a mess and a bit of blood in its wake. In the principal's words, "Certainly something I've never seen happen before." Last week also brought word that nearly 170 dogs were rescued from a rural property in Worth County near the Minnesota border. County authorities executed a search warrant at a commercial breeder known as Whitefire Kennel. The American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals called the operation a puppy mill. The animals ranged in age from young puppies to 9 years old. And speaking of dogs, or at least something associated with dogs, the Des Moines Register had a story online this past Friday with a headline asking why the city had a rather unpleasant smell, a smell that resembled something that dogs often do. Well, the Register found the answer. seems that farmers who had harvested their crops north and northwest of Des Moines had spread manure on their fields. And the wind picked up that smell and blew it right over the metro area. One more quick note before we go, and it's about college football this past weekend. Iowa State University's football team lost to Texas 24-10 and also lost any chance to take part in the Big 12 championship game. The Cyclones' next game will be this coming Saturday against Kansas State at Jack Trice Stadium. Meanwhile, the University of Iowa annihilated Illinois 63-0. And the University of Northern Iowa also won easily, defeating Missouri State 37-0. And that is your summary of another busy, busy week of news around the state of Iowa. I'm Dennis Hart, reminding you that I'll be right back here on Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, with a look at news from the pages of the Ames Tribune. Have a happy Thanksgiving and a great week.
Thank you, Dennis Hart. We also heard a Lutheran hymn. Most of us know it as Morning Has Broken by Cat Stevens, right? And we heard Mashed Potatoes by James Brown and Earth Healer sung by a drumming circle of Northern Cree. And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm one of your hosts for this hour, Ursula Rudenberg, here with Pat Schlarbaum and Susan Franson.
We are conducting our end-of-the-year membership drive. If you have not made your member donation of $55 or more, we ask you to please consider doing so at this time. You can call 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. Or go make a donation online at khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. You'll find the donate button on the homepage. And if you've already donated, we thank you very much. Thank you.
Great Harvest Bread Company is a new addition to the downtown business community. It's on Burnett Avenue between 5th and 6th Street. Owner Kim Sharp has joined us. Kim is a longtime resident of Ames. Welcome, Kim.
We started last November polishing the concrete floors. We finished up around the end of May, opened the 22nd of June this year.
Why did you decide to have a bakery?
Well, I had this big building and needed to do something with it. Seemed logical to put in a nice place where I could take my wife to have a sandwich or get a loaf of bread or a cinnamon roll.
And who does the baking?
I have some very, very talented bakers that have worked around town, at Hy-Vee, at the cafe, and other places. I don't do the baking. I do the tasting.
Well, you must do a good job because I was only in there at lunchtime, but I imagine it's pretty busy right now. You open at 7. Is that
yes,
right?
Ma'am.
Your hours are
yes,
7 ma'am. To 6?
7 till 6 on Monday through Friday and Saturday from 7 till 1 p.m.
Okay.
Or until people leave. Lunch hour between about 11 and 2 is very good. There's certainly a lot of activity we need to get in the morning that we don't have.
Kim, tell us your story. How did you end up doing this?
That's a very good question. I came here in 1969 to finish my PhD program. Graduated with a PhD in economics and statistics, taught at Iowa State University. Have a construction company, Ames Concrete Contractors, and own a retirement community and triplet real estate and insurance and several other businesses in town. And I realized at the age of 78 that my body was starting to complain about pouring concrete. So I decided I need to try something else. I own the building that used to be the Matisse and Ford dealership, for those of you who've lived in Ames a long time. And I had this middle bay, 6,000 square feet. Couldn't get anybody interested in coming to it. Boston Market or the market down in Des Moines and Ankeny that's so popular. I couldn't get anybody. Nobody was interested. So I decided, the heck with you. I'll do it myself.
But you said it is a franchise, but it's a free franchise. You want to
yes.
describe that?
The difference between a free franchise and, a McDonald's franchise, you're pretty restricted in the McDonald's franchise. The free franchise gives you a lot of freedom. You must use the company logo. You must use their products. If you use their recipes, you need to refer to their product with their naming. Other than that, there's a lot of flexibility. So I was allowed to design the building, put in the colors I want. We make most of our products are our products, not the franchise products.
And you can come up with new, like you said something about your chocolate chip cookie recipe. What's that about?
Right. Well, the original chocolate chip cookies were kind of flat and ugly. Maybe that's a preconceived notion on my part, but I like a big, fat, chewy, full of chocolate chip cookie, you know, this, so we worked on that recipe till we got them to that point. The same with the cinnamon rolls. The staff originally made the cinnamon rolls, and I said, no, those aren't cinnamon rolls. They're just bread with a little bit of color in it. I want a lot of brown sugar, a lot of
Thank
cinnamon.
Thank you all for showing
and
up.
And so they made some really nice cinnamon rolls. But they didn't put any frosting on them. And I said, no. We want frosting on the cinnamon rolls. And they said, no. And I said, okay, we'll have a test. We'll make a pan of non-frosted and a pan of frosted, and we'll see which ones go. And they said, that's hardly fair because you stand up front. And I said, I'll just ask people which one they want, the frosted one. So we didn't discuss that anymore. So now the cinnamon rolls are about 5.5 inches by 5.5, 6 inches, 2 inches tall, a lot of cinnamon, a lot of brown sugar, a lot of frosting. Great cinnamon rolls.
I've never seen cinnamon rolls that look like that. They're square.
Yes, they are. Sometimes they're they aren't even square. Sometimes they're weird shapes on the edges, but they're square in the middle anyway.
And you have a pretty big space there. It looks like you might have a private dining room. Do you have?
Yes, we have a dining room, seats about 90. And so we sell sandwiches. A good sandwich has bread, obviously. A good quality bread helps make a good sandwich. So our sandwiches come with all kinds. We have a typical cheese, roast beef, ham, turkey, and then we have some more exotic sandwiches. The most popular sandwich we have is called spicy apple grilled cheese bacon grilled cheese. So it's a very popular sandwich. So they're all, a unique sandwich, and they come with the chips, so it makes it a good buy.
What are your breakfasts like?
Breakfast, we got two great, we have a lot of breakfast products, but we take a baking powder biscuit. We call them a savory biscuit. They're probably three times the size of a typical baking powder biscuit you'd buy at a fast food operation. And they have, they vary each day in terms of what they have in them, cheese, chives, you know, whatever. We cut them in half, slap in some bacon, some ham, some sausage, some cheese, some egg, some tomato, anything else people want. Then we bury them in gravy. Very, very good breakfast.
And very heavy.
Yeah.
And what's your coffee like?
I don't know. Never partaken of coffee in my life, so I don't know. Well, we have three kinds. We have a roast that is medium and a dark and a decaf. I've not had anyone complain about the coffee, though, so I assume it's okay.
I'm curious, you when you were talking about wanting to bring a business into that building, it sounded like you were really just looking at food options for a food business. You were looking for other groceries, other markets?
No, when I originally bought the triplet, well, the Matisse and Ford, my goal was to have a one-stop shop for people where they could come and have their real estate, their insurance, their property management, their lawyer, their banker, their Indian chief, you know, whoever they wanted to interact with. And then the center would be a restaurant-type setting where they could come eat and then go see their lawyer. And then if they didn't feel good, they could come back and eat a cinnamon roll and then go see him again or her.
So you wanted a number of different businesses in
there? Yeah, really. I wanted it to be a really kind of a financial center.
A financial center.
But it became difficult to fill it with all of the things, all the types of professions that I wanted. So we leased the north half of the facility to
Brewery.
Torrent Brewery.
Mm-hmm.
Then the middle half sat vacant till I could procure enough funds, thanks to all the fine bankers, and build the rest of it.
And why did you choose an eating establishment?
Well, golly. That's a good question. You know, I go to some of the facilities in town, and I read a lot about restauranting, and it appears to me that a lot of them are very dark. They're very noisy and loud, and I wanted just the opposite. I wanted a light, bright, cheery, welcoming, happy place. And so the colors are reflective of that. The staff are reflective of it. The product is reflective of it. And I believe the people that come there and partake of it, I would say, are more mature. They're, you know, we don't appeal to maybe everybody, but that's what we're offering.
You find that people from the businesses around there?
Not as much as I thought. I thought we would be inundated with DOT and City of Ames employees. It's picking up, but it isn't overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
It's mostly, honestly, some of the older people who live in town who remember what good bread tastes like and what a good sandwich is like. And don't want the noise and want to be able to read the menu. If you keep up with the Wall Street Journal articles on restauranting all the time, they're discussing how difficult it is to even read menus, that people have to use their phone light, you know, just to even read the menu. So we wanted the opposite type of...
So your menu has big writing.
Big writing.
Yeah, I like that.
And I try to go through the menu with everybody that comes in, if they'll allow me to do so.
Mm-hmm.
I ask them if they need a menu and if they'd like to know more about it, and that helps describe the product also.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of which, you have a private meeting room.
Yes, we have a meeting room. People are allowed. We welcome people to use. It seats 10 to 12 quite comfortably.
And,
of course, we tape
everything.
And who
uses that?
I'm joking, of course.
who uses it?
A lot of church groups and women's groups and professional groups use it.
And
even families. If I see a large family come in, seven or eight, I say, go over and use the room for privacy.
Okay. So it's not something that has to be rented out?
No, it's not rented at all. It's just, you just have to let us know in advance if you'd like to use it, and we'll make it available to you.
Uh-huh. So it's a room where people can use as a meeting room?
Yes, you betcha.
Mm-hmm.
It's very open. We'd love people to come and use it that way.
Mm-hmm.
After, if you're in there more than 4 hours, we begin to wonder, though.
What's going on in there?
Well,
Well, I have a question about numbers. You said, I think you gave the number 99 earlier. You mean this is the what's the total capacity?
The square footage of the facility is around 6,500 square feet. The bakery, the ovens, the mixing bowls, the restrooms, the storage, all take about 3,500 of that. So we have about 2,500 square feet, 3,000 left where we have tables.
Okay. But it's the main restaurant part would seat a lot of people.
Yes.
Maybe, what, 50?
Around 90.
90, so.
And this is Pat Schlarbaum. It sounds like you really personalized your service in a really grand manner here for a university town. How has staffing been going? Have you had to hire family members? Or?
We originally, a lot of the franchise bakeries with Great Harvest are husband and wife teams. I don't think that would work for me, given all my other businesses, to have to work all day long and not, move back and forth. So I pour concrete in the morning, change my clothes, go down and hustle clients from 12 to, 11 to 2, then go change my clothes and go back to work. Uh-huh. So I hired three very talented people that do the baking and the sweets and help manage the making of product. And the young men and young women that we hired are just phenomenal. I have not had one single person quit.
Mm-hmm. So you're off and running. Yeah.
We're what?
You're off and running and contributing to the Ames community.
We have to have about $2,000 worth of sales per day to break even, and we're not very close to that. So we're still losing money.
Oh, well.
But that's all right. I know you're going to come in and buy all the sandwiches.
This will help. What time do you open in the 7 morning?
7 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
We'd even open at 6 if that's what people wanted.
Oh, well.
We start baking around 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, or preparing the product to be baked.
Sound like a great destination.
Well, we think so.
Yeah. One of the things that's interesting about your place is that you can see all of the bakery operation from the dining room. So it's a very open kitchen, and you can kind of see the process.
Yeah, and I take people back that want to see it. We actually, all the wheat comes in 100-pound, 50-pound, 80-pound bags, the oats and the wheats and the flours. Mm-hmm. We grind everything 3 or 4 times a week. So all the wheat is non-GMO. It's only grown in about one place in the United States where it meets the qualifications required by the Great Harvest Bakery.
Where do you know where that is?
Yes, it's in Montana, mm-hmm. close to the Canadian border.
And what are they doing there that's unusual?
It's just a beautiful country in which to grow wheat. The temperatures are just right. The moisture, everything just works well.
Huh. Okay.
All the wheat is tested by the corporate before they allow you to use it or purchase it. And that's one of the requirements. We must use their wheat. But that's what also makes a good product. Mm-hmm. If you take our bread, a loaf of our bread, the way we make it, it only has, if we'd say a white bread, it only has water, salt, yeast, flour, and honey. Mm-hmm. And no additives of any kind. It'll sit on your shelf 15, 20 days in a plastic mm-hmm. bag and will not mold or give you any trouble.
Mm-hmm.
We tell people 10 days.
No sugar. No sugar in the bread.
Oh. Well, honey, I suppose you could argue is a sugar, but there is no sugar.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And if you put sugar and eggs and other products in, then you start getting the spoilage issue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Boy, I can imagine all the daycare facilities and even grade school children coming to a functioning bakery and smelling the smells and really enjoying
it. Yeah, we're thinking of putting the smell in a jar and selling it.
There you go.
Well, you have to come in for that, right?
Yes, right.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we're speaking with Kim Sharp, owner of Great Harvest Bread Company. No, it's Great Harvest Bread
Bakery and Cafe.
Bakery and Cafe. Mm-hmm. What is your website?
Well, that's a good question. You can tell that I'm 78 years old.
Mm-hmm. So where are you physically located then? Where's the brick and mortar?
We're located on the corner of Burnett and Fifth Street, 502. Burnett is the address the city allocated mm-hmm. to us.
Just east of the bank. First.
That's correct. Right across bank. The street mm-hmm. east of the bank, mm-hmm. first of U.S. Bank, so in Ames, Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do your banking and go for, out for breakfast.
That's right. Then go back and see your lawyer or come use our real estate agency or whatever, you know.
So thank you, Kim. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
Any last words?
No, I appreciate it. It's kind of you to invite me to be with you today. I appreciate your interest in our facility. We have a great product. We really do. I've not received a negative comment except from one lady that said she didn't like the cinnamon rolls.
Oh.
And she said I said, I've never received any complaint about the cinnamon rolls. And she said, well, it's my husband. He likes them, and he's eating them, and he's getting fat.
So that was backhanded compliment. That's great. You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Thank you to everyone who came out to public KHOI's public event last night, and thank you, Kim, for coming by. And the event on Friday featured Nicholas Johnson, and we heard from this renowned FCC commissioner who is an Iowan. And we raised around $6,000 for KHOI, which is part of our end-of-the-year fundraising effort, which helps us towards our goal towards $40,000 by January 1st. We wanted to share with you a few excerpts from what Mr. Johnson said on Friday night, which included words of support for KHOI.
Thank you all for showing up and coming to the support of KHOI. I've made some contributions, and many of you have. Keep this very important institution going. And that's what I'm going to talk about tonight, but I'm going to put it in context. Among the first institutions to come under attack in the 49 dictatorships, authoritarianship, whatever you want to call them around the world, there is pressure from these folks to turn other democracies into dictatorships. So this is increasing. And what do they do with regard to the media? Well, they have massive propaganda efforts. They get in and revise the school books in the schools. They punish journalists and publishers, sometimes, as I've noted, with assassination. They try to reduce the public's trust in the media because the media, like the judiciary, is a check, deliberately a check, on abuses by executives, by leaders. And so they need to reduce the public's trust in the media. In fact, the media is not the only institution that's under siege right now. This may sound shocking, but I think our democracy may well not survive the attacks upon it from home and abroad right now. I'll repeat that. I think it's possible that our democracy will not survive. That's a reality that I think we've got to deal with. Take this seriously. I'm not here just to entertain you tonight. And like climate change, there comes a time, there comes a red line when you cross it, when the life of a democracy, or indeed human life on Earth, can no longer be resuscitated. We've already lost lots of endangered species. Well, we're just another species, let me remind you. Like a good marriage, a good democracy is something we have to work at. An apocryphal story is told of a poll in a community. They went around and they asked people, what do you think is the worst problem in our community? Is it ignorance or apathy? Plurality response was, ignorance or apathy? I don't know and I don't care. Well, a democracy requires people who do know and do care have access to the accurate and relevant facts that they need and the education to understand them and the interest and energy and motivation to act accordingly and to fulfill the responsibility that a democracy puts on each of us as individuals. Most democracies do not become dictatorships because of some military invasion, let alone invasions from Central America of people looking for relief. Most come from internal defection, leaders who use the very rights that democracies make possible. reports of hate crimes are markedly up from what they have been to now annually 7,100 a year. That's reality. That's where we are right now. The question is, which direction are we going to move? You can't buy democracy in a store. You can't pass a law and create a democracy. There are only nations and their peoples whose institutions make democracy possible. And those institutions are to a democracy what the pillars or the pilings underneath one of those beach houses right there on the ocean has to protect them from the storm surge coming from the ocean. But when they are damaged and destroyed, democracy collapses. Communication and the media were thought to be central by our founders and remain so today. As President Thomas Jefferson famously said, "Were it left to me to decide whether we should have governments without newspapers or newspapers without governments, I should never hesitate to choose the latter." That's how important he thought it was. Think about the number of words that begin with C-O-M-M. You know, there's, of course, commune, the commons, communal, communitarian, but also community and communication, because community is the essential chemical ingredient that makes a democracy. And that's right here. It's with those of you gathered here this evening. You, every one of you here, can participate more in the media that exists in this community, including KHOI, and thereby make an additional contribution to maintaining our democracy.
That was former FCC Commissioner Nicholas Johnson speaking in Ames on Friday night about the media, democracy, and in support of KHOI. And we ask you to be a part of the KHOI family, specifically at this time, to become a member donor. The easiest way to do this is to go to khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org, and use the secure donate link. And if you would please consider being a sustaining member, $250 a year, and it will really cover these logistical necessities for the station here. We've got to pay the light bill. We got to pay the rent, and we want to keep this KHOI community family growing and serving the Ames community. So if you prefer to call us, there are plenty of us here, and we'd love to take your call at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. Now, phenology is something linking what's happening in nature this time of year. Lee Searles, who was associated with White Rock Conservancy at the time, had an epiphany that this would be something that would benefit the environmental community. So we've been following along in Lee's steps. Let's learn about white-breasted nuthatches today. Today's phenology is about white-breasted nuthatches. The delightful little bird was stealthily creeping along the tree trunk upside down, sideways and straight ahead. Suddenly it flared its tail and wings to aggressively move against other birds at the feeder. Its territorial posture displayed a willingness to go to battle. Obviously the nuthatch was laying claim to all the seeds in the feeder. They are a common feeder bird with clean black, gray, and white markings. White-breasted nuthatches are active, agile little birds with an appetite for insects and large, meaty seeds, like black oil sunflower seeds. They get their common name from their habit of jamming large nuts and acorns into tree bark, then whacking them with their sharp bill to hatch out the seed from the inside. White-breasted nuthatches may be small, but their voices are loud, and often their insistent nasal yammering will lead you right to them in the woods. In winter, white-breasted nuthatches join foraging flocks led by chickadees or titmice, perhaps partly because it makes food easier to find, and partly because more birds can keep an eye out for predators. At bird feeders, they eat sunflower seeds, peanuts, suet, and peanut butter. They can be found year-round at any wooded park. Readily attracted to bird feeders for sunflower seeds or suet, the white-breasted nuthatch may spend much of its time industriously carrying seeds away to hide them in crevices. Young are fed entirely on insects and spiders. Pairs remain together on nesting territory all year. They may mate for life. Courtship behavior begins by late winter. In courtship displays, the male raises its head, spreads its tail, droops the wings, sways back and forth, and bows deeply. Males also perform much courtship while feeding the female. Nest site is a large natural cavity or old woodpecker hole, usually 15 to 60 feet above ground. They may rarely use bird houses, and they may sometimes excavate their own nest cavity, like a woodpecker would. Female builds the nest in a cavity, a simple cup of bark fibers, grasses, twigs, and hair. Adults may spend minutes at a time sweeping the outside and inside of the nest with a crushed insect held in its bill. Chemical secretions of insects may help repel predators. Also, sometimes they add mud to the rim of the nest entrance. White-breasted nuthatches have a cousin that visits Iowa's on occasion, the red-breasted nuthatch. They do not nest in Iowa, yet it's considered an attractive visitor each winter. They seem fearless of humans, possibly because near their nesting areas in northern states and Canada, they do not see many humans. They will tolerate us close to their feeder. Their appearance is sporadic and usually includes the term eruptive. Eruptive is a way to describe migration conditions that we do not see regularly, yet can appear every few years pretty consistently. They forage upon pine nuts in northern states, and during good years, their numbers increase to the point we see some across central Iowa in the winter. Like all nuthatches, they creep up, down, and sideways, without regard for which way is up, and they don't lean against their tail the way woodpeckers do. Their flight is short and bouncy, like their cousin, the white-breasted nuthatch. And that's our phonology for today about white-breasted nuthatches in Iowa. Theme music is from John Barleycorn Must Die by Traffic, and this is Pat Schlarbaum with KHOI Community Radio 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames. Become a member or find the donate button at the website khoifm.org.
Without the little boy,
thank you, Pat Schlarbaum. That was our environmental reporter, Pat Schlarbaum. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, and I'm here also with Susan Franson. This is Local Talk, and Pat has been our environmental reporter now since we started in 2012, as far as I remember.
Pretty much close to that. And we want to link our listeners to the wildlife community, and
that's right.
It's kind of a nice touch.
So this is one of the things that's unique about KHOI. And one of the things that you get when you have a community radio station, you have a, or at least this community radio station with Pat Schlarbaum in your community, because community radio really is a medium which features the talent and the skills and the knowledge that's held in the community. And we're lucky to have somebody like Pat who holds that knowledge, having worked in the Department of Natural Resources and really having developed a very strong relationship to the environment.
I think it appeals to a universal trait in all of us to kind of stay grounded, not only with the Ames community, but with our parks and Ada Hayden facility that is something that we're trying to grow and not to overlook or take for granted. It's right. Like anything else.
And they say that community radio is the voice of the voiceless.
Yeah.
We have taken that to a new level because we speak for the plants and the animals.
I was told that one time that you need to be a voice for the bluebirds. And I thought, oh, okay. You know, that was literally 35 years ago.
So if you want to support the bluebirds and all the other, the number to call is 515-292-2878. Or you can go to khoifm.org and click the donate button. We are very fortunate to have Pat among us. I've learned a great deal from you, Pat.
Kind of the go-between role. It's really the wildlife. And it's important that we maintain our natural areas, and it's important that we maintain our community radio. If you could please consider becoming a sustaining member at the level of $250 annually. It's how we can really build KHOI family, and we can strengthen this KHOI community.
And thank you for those who have supported KHOI, and thank you, Pat, for having brought us this work about the environment for so many years.
Yeah. And this gets along on the lines that we all have a friendship that we rely upon for counsel and encouragement and inspiration, and a man that I had the good fortune of meeting and networking with in Northeast Iowa that was involved with the recovery of the Peregrine Falcons back on the cliffs in his way. So I'd like to share some of this man's story. Tim Mason from Marquette, Iowa. We all know someone that inspires our friendship to support and honor what it is that makes us tick. From our Friday night friends to a backyard chef's barbecue surprises, our lives are invigorated by their gifts of time. Their love and encouragement drives us to become whom we want to be. Friends who seem bigger than life, that we can count on for counsel from time to time. Such a person is Tim Mason from Marquette, Iowa. Historian, conservationist, trout fisherman, or political satirist, and some would say radical environmentalist hellraiser, Tim covers all the bases. Tim grew up on the banks of the trout stream Bloody Run in Marquette, Iowa, in far northeast Iowa. In his life, there are many environmental causes he championed. He led an environmental action for saving Bloody Run twice, once from a highway going through it, and the second when a casino parking lot had been planned for its shores. In like manner, he saved Steinbegill Trout Stream, south of McGregor, from a casino water park development. And there have been many more. As a naturalist for the National Park Service at Effigy Mounds, to a shantyboat captain with his wife Sarah on the Mississippi, this fifth-generation outdoorsman's environmental work is nothing short of amazing. Yet it was in the area of hawks and hawk banding that Tim's role is unequaled. In 1992, the Iowa Department of Natural Resources had completed a peregrine falcon reintroduction effort to Iowa. DDT of the 1950s had wiped out falcon nesting from the Missouri River to the East Coast, and 50 young pre-flight ISs, or young falcons, were placed at three sites in Iowa, Cedar Rapids, Des Moines, and Muscatine. And as a result, two pairs successfully nested in 1993 in urban areas of Cedar Rapids and Des Moines. Meanwhile, the historic falcon nest sites of Northeast Iowa, where these birds nested historically, were falcon poor. Surveys were turning up zero activity upon historic cliffs by these majestic birds, and one such prominent cliff upstream from Marquette was called Painted Rock. And Tim was considered an historian to a local circle of Marquette friends, and he knew the history of Painted Rock. It was first mentioned in writings by early explorers Marquette and Joliet. In historic literature, the site was referred to as Paint Rock or Sacred Paint Rock, and many pictographs or drawings with red ochre paint are still in evidence on the bleached white layers of sandstone, hence the name Paint Rock. The pictographs or drawings were made by the mound builders from thousands of years ago. Tim provided vision to remain eternally vigilant in our quest to have peregrines flying freely over their historic bluffs. It was important to return them in such a way that future generations would honor their presence, to not place them in jeopardy of losing them again. Keep them with us in the current time frame. The Peregrine Falcon recovery would remain focused until falcons were back on the historic cliffs, specifically near Sacred Paint Rock. It would not be painted. It would be a current present tense and drop the ED of the past tense. Paint Rock. Falcons leave a mute plume of whitewash, or their droppings, near their nest sites, and during an inspection of the rock ledge of Sacred Paint Rock, some whitewash was placed streaking below the ledge. Whitewash or paint was placed in a respectful manner. Knowing its spiritual significance to the native community, we learned that area of northeast Iowa is not included in Meskwaki history. It is the Ho-Chunk Nation, or Winnebagos at Black River Falls, Wisconsin, who include it spiritually. We would need to correlate any falcon work concerning sacred cliffs at a near Paint Rock with the Ho-Chunk Nation. So within the year, a freelance photographer named Barb Schoner contacted Tim to photograph eagles. When it was learned she carried a native pipe with the Ho-Chunk, Tim passed her contact information along. And a first-time meeting with Ho-Chunk elders was scheduled before the Effigy Mounds Hawk Watch weekend in 1994 with Lyle Greendeer Sr. and his family of seven children. Mr. Greendeer told us the red ochre paint of Sacred Paint Rock would continue to erode or age away, and when it had disappeared, the earth would experience an Armageddon. It had been prophesied that other nations would ask their native nation for guidance concerning this sacred site. Each year, the bluffs were surveyed in anxious anticipation of falcons returning to them, yet each year, urban falcons in the cities would fight to the death for urban territories, and the urban falcons were not spilling over into their previous natural nest sites. So the Iowa Falconers and Bob Anderson from Minnesota believed falcons imprint upon their surroundings in such a way that urban falcons did not recognize historic nest sites. And Bob, as director of the Raptor Resource Project, was a falcon breeder and relocated his operation to Ridgeway, Iowa, just outside Decorah. And yes, Bob did then become the director for the world-famous Decorah Eagle Cam. But from Bob's six nesting pairs of captive falcons, a plan was formulated to release falcons from Hanging Rock of Effigy Mounds National Monument near Sacred Paint Rock. The release of young peregrines was a success, as all 19 released birds survived, and in early 2000, falcons nested just upstream from Paint Rock. The Ho-Chunk Nation's blessings and prayers for this work and the Raptor Resource Project had succeeded. Falcons had returned as a nesting species to the cliffs overlooking the greatest flyway on the planet of the Mississippi River as it passes through the Driftless, which is what the locals call that area of northeast Iowa, the Driftless. It was a wonderful opportunity to work with a local environmentalist like Tim Mason. We needed that local support, and we needed the Ho-Chunk blessing. Tim's vision of falcons over Sacred Paint Rock was being realized, and what better species to carry into the 21st century than an iconic species so important to the flyway? Peregrine falcons became the standard bearer of the Endangered Species Act. Their return to the flyway and the food chain as a species is nothing short of epic. Many feel it rivals the significance of the return of our national symbol, the bald eagle. Yet Tim passed away September 12, 2018 from kidney failure as peregrines were flying over the Sacred Paint Rock. So now our conversations have grown into a spiritual realm. They're still the same, yet different in a positive manner. If you're driving through Driftless Bluffs of northeast Iowa and see a peregrine falcon soaring over the Mississippi River, let the Ho-Chunk Nation, the Raptor Resource Project, and Tim Mason know your gratitude. Thank you, Tim. Your environmental stewardship of our dear Driftless area of northeast Iowa continues. And thanks for just being Tim. Till next time, my friend. May your work in environmental stewardship grow from this generation to the next and the next forever. So if your life is enriched with someone like a Tim Mason, let them know they are making a difference to our culture, our family and friends, and they are making a difference to our beautiful land of Iowa. Tell them thanks. This is Pat Schlarbaum with KHOY Community Radio, 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames. Thank you, Tim. Sure gonna miss that guy.
Have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We've been your hosts for this hour, Ursula Rudenberg, Susan Franzen, and Pat Schlarbaum. Local Talk was engineered by Cynthia McClure. Our guest was Kim Sharp. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! At 8 a.m., beginning with headline news, and for Morning Masterpieces at 9 a.m. Please remember that your participation and support as audience is what makes Local Talk and KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.